a slightly modified version of TDCS. Thanks to @HaloNeuro for letting me and my teammates try these out. McAdoo tweeted, looking forward to seeing the results. As the basketball season wore on, the Warriors rolled over opponents with unprecedented ease, eventually finishing with a new regular season record of 73 wins and just 9 losses. No one attributed their success to Halo's TDCS headphones, which a trainer for the team confirmed an unspecified number of players had experimented with. But the high-tech device fit in with the team's techno-utopian storyline. Since the then-bumbling Warriors franchise was purchased by a group of Silicon Valley venture capitalists in 2010, it has acquired a reputation as tech's team, playing with the wonky, numbers-driven approach of Sandhill Road venture capitalists. The Warriors have also been enthusiastic early adopters of technology, ranging from intelligent sleep masks for countering jet lag to body-worn sensors that detect pressure on the knees and ankles. Now they were among the first to try brain stimulation, and as their rivals, not to mention fans and amateur athletes, couldn't help noticing, they were winning a lot of games. Halo was founded in 2013 by Daniel Chow and Brett Weingier, who had previously worked together at a company that used another form of brain stimulation to treat epilepsy. Their headphones are designed to work in much the same way that Red Bull tried with cyclists. Not coincidentally, Andy Walsh, Red Bull's director of high performance, is prominently listed as an advisor on Halo's website. The electrodes are positioned to trickle current through the motor cortex, and you can adjust the settings to focus on the brain regions associated with upper body muscles, lower body muscles, or both depending on your intended activity. Don the headphones for 20 minutes during your warm-up, activate them with the associated app, and your brain will learn to deliver stronger, more synchronous signals to your muscles, the company claims. While Priori's and Okano's studies generated a surge of interest in TDCS for sports, subsequent results have been mixed. In early 2017, a team at the University of Kent's Endurance Research Group, led by Alexis Mauger, reviewed the existing literature on how TDCS affects endurance, which they defined as continuous exercise lasting longer than 75 seconds. The 10 other studies they located were all published in 2013 or later, and the protocols they used were all over the map. Different stimulation times, currents, electrode placements, exercises, and so on. Overall, 8 of 12 studies showed improved performance, while 4 saw no change. Halo has conducted its own unpublished pilot studies with groups like the U.S. Ski Team, claiming impressive improvements in propulsive force for ski jumpers, after repeated use in training, for example. But without a properly blinded placebo control group. The company says it plans to submit research to peer-reviewed journals, but its initial strategy relied on a familiar Silicon Valley script, distributing to high-profile athletes like McAdoo and hoping for good word of mouth. It's difficult, then, to make any sort of informed judgment about Halo's headphones. When I wrote about them for The New Yorker as Golden State attempted to clinch a second consecutive NBA title, I concluded that at worst they functioned as an industrial-strength placebo, a gadget with real, if disputed, science behind it, whose benefits are supposed to be all in your head. Golden State lost anyway to LeBron James's Cleveland Cavaliers, but when Halo called and offered to lend me a pair for a month to try for myself, I decided, despite my long-standing distrust of subjective gear reviews, to give it a shot. By wiring myself up with a GPS watch, heart rate monitor, and high-tech multi-axial accelerometer to analyze my stride parameters, I figured I might be able to detect whether brain stimulation had any measurable impact on my running. I should pause here to explain that, as a journalist who covers sports science and technology, I am inundated on a near daily basis with offers to try out new products, ranging from delicious-sounding energy bars to insanely complicated electro-adaptive t-shirt running coach stride analyzers. I invariably decline, because my goal is to write about whether things work, not whether I like them. And for me, the former goal feels easier when I don't have an opinion about the latter. I want data, not feelings. So agreeing to trial the Halo headphones was a big departure for me, one that reflects the unusually strong interest aroused by the idea of brain stimulation. The prospect that you might be able to unlock your body's hidden reserves of endurance simply and painlessly by running a few electrons through a carefully selected part of your brain fascinated me. It felt like the culmination of a search that had spanned more than two decades since that night in Sherbrooke when a linguistic misunderstanding had somehow unlocked my potential as a 1,500-meter runner. Except that it wasn't painless. The headphones come with three electrode pads, each with 24 little foam spikes that you soak in saline solution before each use to make good electrical contact with your head. But I'm bald, and apparently the harsh Canadian climate has toughened my scalp to an unusual degree. In order to get the green light indicating that the electrodes had achieved contact, I had to press the headphones so hard that I would get deep divots across the top of my head. Sometimes I couldn't make contact at all, and when I did, turning on the current elicited a fierce burning sensation even on the lowest setting. On the rare occasions that I managed to endure 20 minutes of neuropriming, I was so frustrated and uncomfortable that if anything, I felt worse when I finally headed out the door to run. This, I should emphasize, is precisely the sort of subjective experience that doesn't tell us much about whether the technique works. But I was glad I hadn't spent $750 on it. What will it mean if brain stimulation really works? One obvious specter is brain doping, a possibility that Alexandre Ocano acknowledged when I asked him about the implications of his research. The technique will lead to benefits comparable to using drugs, he said, and there is no way to detect reliably whether or not a person has recently experienced brain stimulation. The safety risks of TDCS are thought to be minimal, though some researchers point out the lack of long-term studies, especially on the developing brains of young people, but the ethics of brain boosting will nonetheless require plenty of debate. Personally, my gut instinct is to hope that anti-doping authorities proactively ban the technique before it becomes widespread, simply because I'm uncomfortable with imagining my 16-year-old self, desperate for any athletic edge, playing around with scalp-mounted electrodes. But I fully understand that others might disagree with banning an apparently safe and non-invasive way of boosting performance. To researchers like Alexis Mauger, TDCS is interesting as a research tool rather than a competitive aid, just as in his earlier studies he used Tylenol to boost endurance in order to demonstrate the importance of pain, TDCS offers an unprecedented tool to probe the role of different sensations and brain regions in regulating endurance. And on a practical level, Mauger's most recent research hints at a potential methodological breakthrough, as well as an explanation for the current mess of seemingly conflicting results. Most TDCS studies place both electrodes on the skull, which means you enhance the excitability of neurons under the negative electrode, but suppress the excitability of those under the positive electrode. So, the benefits that one electrode giveth, the other may taketh away, depending on exactly where it's placed. As an alternative, Mauger tried placing the positive electrode on the shoulder instead of the skull while stimulating the motor cortex. The results were immediately encouraging, a reduction in perceived effort accompanied by a 23% increase in time to exhaustion on the bike with the shoulder electrode compared to no change in either parameter when both electrodes were on the skull. Still, translating lab research into a real-world competitive context remains a formidable barrier. This challenge was on my mind on my fourth day in California when the Red Bull cyclists, trailed by their entourage of scientists, headed to the StubHub Velodrome for a final round of testing. Away from the controlled environment of the lab and its futile stationary bikes, it was easier to connect the dry, clinical discussions of maximal voluntary contraction and task failure with the messy reality of no-holds-barred competition. On the first 4-kilometer time trial of the day, Tim Johnson, the cyclocross champion, notched the fastest time with a 5-minute 20 seconds. Jesse Thomas, the ultra-distance triathlete, was just 2 seconds back. A few hours later, after another round of brain stimulation, Thomas managed to drop his time to 5 minutes 10 seconds, then stood on the sidelines cheering as Johnson, wheels tracing a perfectly level contour around the steep curves, tried to reclaim the throne. Stopwatches clicked as Johnson whizzed past the finish in 5 minutes 17 seconds. "Did I get him?" he panted as he circled past the finish line again a moment later. Thomas laughed, savoring the moment. "That's the first thing I asked when I finished, too. It's the same mindset." He glanced around at the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of machinery arrayed on the infield, the laptops and transmitters, the sensors and wires poking out of his bike shorts. "You can do all this shit, but it all comes down to two guys on a bike trying to beat each other." I've thought a lot about brain stimulation since then. Its potential as a research tool, its hasty and, as far as my scalp is concerned at least, premature commercialization, its likely impact on the acceptable boundaries of athletic self-improvement, and Thomas's comments have stuck with me. Because the morning after his battle with Johnson, before heading to the airport, I cornered one of the scientists and asked for a peek at the randomization protocol. In each of the two races, it turned out, the winner had received sham stimulation, while the loser had received the real thing. You can't draw any conclusions about whether TDCS works from a single anecdote, but it nonetheless felt like a hype-dousing splash of cold water. Maybe, I reflected, the electrodes are beside the point. From Red Bull's perspective, the goal of bringing its athletes together for these camps, whether for brain stimulation or breath-hold training, is to teach athletes that they're capable of more than they think. Brain stimulation may or may not turn out to be an effective way of accessing your hidden reserves, but there was little doubt that the athletes at the camp came away from the experience convinced that these reserves exist. In the end, when it comes down to two guys on a bike, maybe that's the real secret weapon, believing that you have another gear. Chapter 13. Belief. I spent the evening before the 2003 Cherry Blossom 10-mile run poring obsessively over the list of elite entrants. There were about 24 names on the men's list, the vast majority of them from Kenya, vying for a share of the $30,000 prize pot offered by the venerable Washington, D.C. mega race. Though I had plenty of experience with track and cross-country races, this was my first serious foray into the big-money world of road racing. The top 12 finishers would get cash, and as I scrolled through the names and Googled their past accomplishments, I expected I would be right on the bubble. The next morning, I set off from the blossom-strewn National Mall with 15,000 other runners. The elite group quickly separated themselves from the throng behind them. But the real racing didn't start right away. For the first 2 miles, everyone waited and watched, clipping their strides and listening to the rasp of their competitors' breathing. Finally, the Kenyan pair of John Carrier and Reuben Cheruiyot, who between them had won the last 3 editions of the race, hit the front. The pace surged, the nervous energy of the tightly bunched pack was exhaled, and the race was on. In a sense, every stride you take during a race is a micro decision. Will you speed up, slow down, or maintain your current pace? But some decisions are more consequential than others. As Carrier and Cheruiyot telescoped away, leaving the shrapnel of the exploded lead pack in their wake, I had to decide how hard to chase. I wasn't concerned about pace or splits. I'd logged enough miles on the razor's edge over the previous decade to be able to feel in my gut precisely what was sustainable and what wasn't. I was as fit as I had ever been, and let's be honest, wanted cash. But I was also disciplined and pragmatic. As the runners around me abruptly launched into what seemed like a near sprint, I accelerated more steadily, hoping to hit the maximum pace I could sustain for the 8 remaining miles. Soon, all 24 runners in the lead pack were receding into the distance in front of me. But I hoped to see at least some of them again. My memories of the second half of that race are still vivid. The thrill of the hunt as one by one I began to track down and pass the stragglers. Some of them put up a brave fight. Others were barely jogging. You could almost see the metaphorical cloud of black smoke billowing from their overheated engines. Late in the race, I caught Simon Rono, a Kenyan who a few years earlier had notched the second fastest winning time in the race's history, to move into 12th place. I was in the money. With a few hundred yards remaining, some friends cheering on the sidelines pointed up the road and another Kenyan runner wobbling toward the finish. I lowered my head and charged, edging him just before the line to increase my payout from $200 to $250. For years afterward, I told that story as a tale of triumph, a humble brag about my finely honed pacing acumen. Knowing my limits and racing within them had allowed me to beat half the elite runners in the race. The others, I assumed, were simply faster than me, and I wouldn't have beaten them under any circumstances. It wasn't until almost a decade later, after many similar racing experiences, that I finally began to question that narrative. Reed Coulsette was wide awake, sprawled the wrong way on his hotel bed so that he could prop his legs up against the headboard. It was the night before the 2011 Toronto Waterfront Marathon, and outside the window a strong breeze scudded briskly along the exposed lakefront boulevard, where the next morning he would try to run a qualifying time for the London Olympics. The gears of his mind spun restlessly, cranking out the mental arithmetic of kilometer splits for different paces and different scenarios. 2 hours 11 minutes 29 to qualify, 2 hours 10 minutes 9 seconds or 3 minutes 5 seconds per kilometer to erase Jerome Drayton's 36-year-old Canadian record. In training, he had drummed that pace into his mind and legs until it felt automatic. As at Cherry Blossom, the front of the pack would be dominated by East African runners, mostly Kenyan and Ethiopian, aiming for a time several minutes faster than Drayton's record. They were irrelevant, to Coulsette. His only adversary, whether for fulfilling his Olympic dreams or collecting a $36,000 bonus for breaking the record, was the clock. But something didn't feel quite right. Finally, he pulled out his earbuds, climbed out of bed, and padded downstairs to the hotel bar, where his longtime coach, Dave Scott Thomas, was having a beer. "I want to go out with the leaders tomorrow," he said, "and I want you to tell me if that's insane or not." Scott Thomas had been working with Coulsette since 1998, shepherding him in gradual increments from mediocre university walk-on to world-class distance runner. Methodical planning and realistic goal-setting formed the bedrock of their coach-athlete relationship. But beneath Coulsette's apparent uncertainty, Scott Thomas sensed a seam of hard-earned confidence. "Why not?" he said, nodding. "Go for it." With months of strategizing abruptly discarded, Coulsette headed upstairs, crawled back into bed, and fell peacefully asleep within minutes. The next morning, as the race started with the usual exuberance, thousands of runners surging across the start line and down University Avenue like lava from a long-plugged volcano, I was leaning out the window of a press truck driving 40 or 50 meters ahead of the field, watching as the front runners began to coalesce into distinct packs. The East Africans in the lead, then the Canadian Olympic hopefuls, followed by the top women the top regional runners, and so on. As the miles ticked past, I started to exchange puzzled glances and raised eyebrows with a few other reporters. An 11-man lead pack formed a ragged arrowhead across the road. 10 of the men were from Kenya and Ethiopia, but clearly visible at the back of the pack was an incongruous shock of red hair. As the runners streaked past a banner indicating the 5K mark, Coolsayat glanced down at his watch, clicked a button, and carried on running with the leaders. The torrid start wasn't a mistake, we realized. Coolsayat had abandoned the careful pacing plan he had outlined at the pre-race press conference a few days earlier and was running to win. By this time, I was fully accustomed to the typical patterns of road racing, the kamikaze attacks of the East Africans at the front of the pack, and the sober caution of the North American chasers. I assumed that the differences, a broad but not universal generalization admittedly, could be attributed to simple economics. I once spent time with a manual laborer turned runner named Joseph Nderitu, who told me about his first year racing in North America when he managed to return home with $600 in his pocket, enough to buy 2 calves. The following year, after an even better season, he bought a quarter acre of land for $2,500, built a 5-room house, and bought another cow. The first cow for milking ever in my family, he told me with pride. For someone like me, running a personal best time and placing 6th in a race where prize money was offered to the top 5 might be chalked up as a victory of sorts. For Nderitu, the self-actualization of a personal best would be a poor substitute for cash. But to those who have actually spent time in Kenya and gotten to know the legions of aspiring runners there, this pat explanation doesn't capture the whole truth. Coolsayat, for example, regularly spent several months a year in Kenya, training with locals in the thin highland air. Even in training sessions with nothing but pride on the line, he noticed that Kenyan and Western runners had markedly different mentalities. The Kenyan up-and-comers would simply run with the leaders, often international champions, for as long as possible, then drop out or start jogging when they could no longer keep up. Coolsayat and other foreigners, meanwhile, would maintain a steady but sustainable pace. At one point, he took some friends to watch the famous weekly fartlek workout in the hills around the town of Itten. More than 200 runners streamed past them, raising a cloud of red dust from the dirt roads. About a third of them had dropped out of the workout before the halfway mark. After hearing enough of these stories, I finally started to consider the obvious question. Given how good the Kenyans are, should I be emulating their racing style rather than laughing at it? There is, after all, something inherently limiting about the fetishization of even pacing. If you execute a perfectly paced race, that means you effectively decided within the first few strides how fast you could complete the full distance. There is no opportunity to surprise yourself with an unexpectedly good day. You've put a ceiling on your potential achievement from the moment the starting gun fires. As a result, this approach may produce better results on average, but it is less likely to produce dramatic outliers, jaw-droppingly fast or slow times. Looking back at my cherry blossom results, I see that I beat some blue-chip runners like Simon Rono, the former champion, who would never have lost to me if they had raced more conservatively, but I also lost to some considerably less credentialed runners, another Kenyan named Francis Komu, for example, whose typical performances were pretty similar to my own. The difference in Komu's racing history is that by racing aggressively, he now and then hit one out of the park, like he did that day in Washington when he beat me by a minute and a half. Instead of a consistent string of pretty good performance, he opted for a few great ones mixed in with some undeniable stinkers, which, when I thought about it, was a pretty good trade. And that, it seemed, was the choice Coolsayat was making in the Toronto Marathon on that windy morning in 2011, when the leaders passed halfway on pace to run under 2 minutes 8 seconds, more than 2 minutes faster than the Canadian record and nearly 3.5 minutes faster than Coolsay's previous best. He was still tucked right behind them. So if it's not just about the money, why do Kenyans run the way they do? According to filmmaker and former elite runner Michael Del Monte, who spent months in the heart of Kenyan running culture while filming the documentary Transcend about the rise of marathoner-turned-politician Wesley Korir, it comes down to belief. Even the humblest Kenyan runner, he noticed, wakes up every morning with the firm conviction that today, finally, will be his or her day. They run with the leaders because they think they can beat them. And if harsh reality proves that they can't, they regroup and try again the next day. And that belief, fostered by the long-standing international dominance of generations of Kenyan runners, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. To sports scientists in an academic setting, placebo is a dirty word. The placebo effect is what skews the results of their experiments, and it's what allows charlatans to get rich peddling ineffective performance boosters. But for those working with elite athletes in real-life settings, the picture is different. In 2013, physiologists Shona Halson and David Martin of the Australian Institute of Sport wrote an editorial in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance in which they argued for a distinction between placebos and belief effects, valuable opportunities to improve athlete performance, which should be enhanced and harnessed rather than suppressed. After all, if a metaphorical sugar pill makes you faster and enables you to win a race, who cares if the effects were all in your head? In fact, Halson and Martin argued the boundary between real ergogenic, performance-enhancing, aids and fake belief effects is much fuzzier than most people, even scientists, realize. They cited an observation by sports scientist Trent Stellingworth, who also coaches athletes, including his wife, Hillary, a two-time Olympic 1500-meter runner. At a conference in 2013, Stellingworth noted the wide variety of supplements and training methods that have been shown to produce a 1-3% boost in performance, from caffeine to beet juice to altitude training. In theory, combining all these approaches should create a super athlete. In practice, studies that combine multiple interventions in elite athletes tend to see overall improvements of 1-3%. If 1+1+1=1, the implication is that many different proven training aids act at least in part on the same target, the brain. That's not an argument in favor of sugar pills, Stellingworth emphasizes. For me, a placebo is direct trickery, giving an athlete an inert substance and saying it is something else. I've never done that except in studies. Harnessing a belief effect, on the other hand, doesn't involve any trickery. Rather, it's very strategically and slowly developing maximal trust, belief, and evidence with your athletes and coaches over time. In the ideal scenario, he says, you're offering advice with real, evidence-backed physiological benefits, while bearing in mind that the words you choose, how much info you provide, and how you describe it can all dictate the eventual performance impact of that intervention. Consider the purported benefits of a post-workout ice bath, which is supposed to ward off inflammation and hasten muscle recovery. Athletes at every level swear by them. Researchers, meanwhile, have published hundreds of studies investigating their effects, with results that are ambiguous at best. If you ask athletes how sore they feel the day after a workout, ice baths seem to help. If you take blood tests to look for objective signs of reduced muscle damage, not so much. It's hard, of course, to have a placebo-controlled ice bath study since you can't disguise the fact that you're immersing yourself in freezing water. But researchers at Australia's Victoria University found a way around this problem in a 2014 study. They compared 15-minute post-cycling workout soaks in either cold water, lukewarm water, or lukewarm water with the addition of a special recovery oil. We made sure that we put the recovery oil in the water in plain sight of the participants, recalls David Bishop, the study's senior author, and we gave them a glossy summary of some made-up research about scientifically proven benefits of recovery oils. Over the following 2 days, the researchers tested their subjects' leg strength, which in the end is the most important recovery outcome. Sure enough, the ice bath significantly outperformed the lukewarm bath throughout the 2 day recovery period. But the recovery oil was just as good, and perhaps even marginally better than the ice bath, even though the oil was in fact a liquid soap called Cetaphil Gentle Skin Cleanser. This, you might think, debunks the value of ice baths once and for all, except for the fact that the athletes who had either ice or oil really did seem stronger in the 2 days following the workout. Like Stellingwerf, Bishop sees the belief effect as a vital tool for coaches and sports scientists to harness. Liquid soap isn't a sustainable deception. Eventually, the athletes will start noticing how uncharacteristically good their teammates smell. Ice baths, which have plausible physiological role in fighting inflammation, can be recommended with a clean conscience. If all this sounds like the sort of self-deluding rationalization you might expect to hear from some potion-peddling alternative medicine guru, rest assured, I share your discomfort. I've written dozens of articles about ice bath research and still struggle with the appropriate message. My general take these days is that if you like ice baths and feel that they help you, you should stick with them. If you don't like them or haven't experienced them, there's no compelling reason you should start. I tend to be harsher on cryo saunas, the mini chambers that dust you with a cloud of supercooled nitrogen vapor for a few minutes. The ambiguities in the research are similar, but spending tens of thousands of dollars on a placebo seems less defensible, though I recognize the inherent contradictions in my position. It's also worth pointing out another flaw in the dichotomy between real and fake effects, which is that placebos can produce measurable biochemical changes. The paradigm-altering demonstration of this phenomenon came in a 1978 study from the University of California, San Francisco, of people recovering from dental surgery. The patients were given IV drips of either morphine or plain saline solution to block their pain. As expected, some placebo responders had reductions in pain even though they only received saline. The researchers then added a drug called naloxone, which counteracts overdoses of morphine and heroin by blocking the body's opioid receptors. This immediately shut off the pain-killing effect of the saline solution, suggesting that its pain-killing powers were the result of a surge of endorphins, the body's internal version of morphine. And it's not just endorphins. Subsequent research has shown many distinct signaling pathways that respond to placebo-driven expectations, including endocannabinoids, which are the body's internal version of cannabis, and the immune system. Coordinating all of these responses is the brain's anticipation and reward system, which depends on the neurotransmitter dopamine. As it happens, there's a gene called COMT that affects how much dopamine is available in the prefrontal cortex of your brain. Those with one version of the gene have 3 to 4 times as much dopamine as those with the opposite version. Researchers at Harvard Medical School's program in placebo studies using sham acupuncture to treat irritable bowel syndrome found that those with the high dopamine version of the gene were far more likely to respond strongly to the placebo treatment. Further evidence that those who do respond to placebos aren't merely imagining the effects. What does all this have to do with the limits of endurance? On the simplest level, taking the equivalent of a sugar pill, if you really believe it will help you race faster, will often work. Chris Beatty, a researcher at Canterbury Christ Church University in Britain, who studies placebos in sport, once had a group of cyclists complete a series of 10-kilometer time trials. The subjects were told they would receive various doses of caffeine before each trial, but they wouldn't be told which dose they had received. As expected, the cyclists rode 1.3% faster when they thought they had received a moderate dose, 3.1% faster after a high dose, and 1.4% slower when they thought they got the placebo. In reality, all the pills were placebos. The performance boost and associated changes in how much pain or effort they perceived during the rides were entirely fueled by their own expectations. Similar belief effects can also show up with no pills in sight. For example, surveys have found that the greater your interest in sports, the more superstitious you're likely to be. Intrigued by all the tales of superstitious super-athletes like Michael Jordan, who famously wore his old college shorts under his uniform throughout his professional career, German researcher Lynn Damisch of the University of Cologne set out to test whether lucky charms actually work. Sure enough, in one study, she found that simply saying, "Here is your ball," so far it has turned out to be a lucky ball, boosted golf putting performance by 33% compared to saying, "This is the ball that everyone has used so far." In other tasks, subjects set higher initial goals and tried for longer before giving up when they had their lucky charms with them. Evidence that what psychologists call self-efficacy, or a belief in their own competence and success, altered their behavior in ways that became self-fulfilling, like the aggressive racing of Kenyan runners. So, yes, self-confidence can make you try harder, but it can also work in more subtle ways. Telling runners they look relaxed makes them burn measurably less energy to sustain the same pace. Giving rugby players a post-game debriefing that focuses on what they did right rather than what they did wrong has effects that continue to linger a full week later, when the positive feedback group will have higher testosterone levels and perform better in the next game. Even doing a good deed, or simply imagining yourself doing a good deed, can enhance your endurance by reinforcing your sense of agency. In one study, donating a dollar to charity enabled volunteers to hold up a 5-pound weight for 20% longer than they otherwise could. Worryingly, they gained even more strength from imagining themselves doing an evil deed. Confirmation, perhaps, of a theory long discussed on online running message boards that the best way to run an 800-meter race is fueled by pure hate. This is not a suggestion that you should rob a convenience store on the way to your next race. Most of these examples, considered on their own, are little more than parlor tricks. Nevertheless, when you step back, a larger pattern comes into focus. When I was visiting Tim Noakes in Cape Town, I asked him what his theories about the brain's role in endurance could tell us about training. If there's a central governor, can you hone it? He answered me with an anecdote. During his days as a rower for the South African University's team in the early 1970s, the crew regularly did a workout of 6 times 500 meters as hard as possible. And one afternoon, we did our sixth and turned around to row back to the boathouse, and the coach says, "No, go to the start again. You're doing another one." So we did another 500. And he said, "Go back," and we did another 4. And you know, no one would have believed that we could do that if you'd asked us. That lesson, he recalled, stuck with him, first as an athlete and later as a scientist. You have to teach athletes somewhere in their careers that they can do more than they think they can. This epiphany has a lot in common with what Amby Burfoot, a former Boston Marathon champion and longtime Runner's World editor, once described as the absolute, no doubt in the world, best running workout you can do. Burfoot was writing about a Yale University study in which the appetite hormones of a group of volunteers plunged after drinking what they were told was an indulgent, high-calorie milkshake, but didn't budge when they drank a sensible, low-calorie shake, even though the two drinks were actually identical. The brain rules the body, Burfoot concluded, which is why his super workout consisted of 5 times a mile as hard as possible, followed by your coach telling you to do another at the same pace. From this workout, you'll learn forever that you're capable of much more than you think, he wrote. It's the most powerful lesson you can possibly learn in running. A vast body of sports-specific studies back this insight up, using various forms of deception to trick people into pushing harder or for longer than they normally can. Rigging the thermometer to display a falsely low temperature counteracts some of the endurance-sapping effects of heat. Using a clock that runs fast or slow, or lying about how much distance an athlete has covered, can help or hurt performance depending on the context. Several studies have used virtual reality systems to allow competitors to race against their own previous performances, a benchmark that, by definition, the subjects are confident they can match. This turns out to be true, even when the virtual rivals are secretly sped up, though only up to a point. Race against a 2% improved version of yourself, and you'll surprise yourself, a 2017 study from French researchers found. Race against a 5% improved version, and you'll soon get discouraged when you realize you can't keep up. But deception can take you only so far. Even if you have a coach who likes to play tricks on you, there's only so many times you'll fall for the old extra interval gag before you start holding back a bit in every workout. To Burfoot, the real point is more general. Deception, he writes, is not central to the phenomenon. It just makes for compelling stories with surprise endings. What's central is strong belief. Shortly after the halfway mark, Coolsett began to drift behind the leaders. As he disappeared from our sight lines on the press truck, we shook our heads knowingly. Confidence is great, but the marathon punishes overconfidence with Old Testament severity. So it was a surprise a few miles later to see him reappear in the distance. Head down, teeth gritted, he doggedly clawed his way back to the lead pack, which by the 30-kilometer mark was down to just 6 runners. In a live roadside interview on the TV race broadcast, his coach bluntly explained the temporary lapse. He had to stop at about 22K to take a dump. For Coolsett, the strong belief that he could race with the Kenyans was earned by training with them. A few months after the Toronto race, back in the training mecca of Iten, high in the hills of the Rift Valley, he once again joined more than 200 Kenyan runners, ranging from complete unknowns to established stars, for the weekly fartlek along the dusty mountain roads outside town. The task was simple. Alternate 2 minutes hard with 1 minute easy, and repeat 20 times. Just as in races, everyone went out hard and hung on for as long as they could. No one wanted to be behind the lone Mzungu, but Coolsett still managed to work his way up and finish near the front. As he jogged back toward town, caked in red dust and sweat, a handful of other runners burst into applause. He was ready to run 2 minutes 5 seconds, they told him, a vote of confidence with the energizing power of a wheelbarrow full of caffeine pills. This sort of earned, transferable belief, if he can do it, so can I, also plays out at the very highest levels of sport. Why is it that world records in virtually every test of human endurance keep edging downward? You might think it's our ever-advancing knowledge of training, nutrition, hydration, recovery, and so on, along with fancy technologies like cryosaunas. But all of this knowledge and technology is applied with equal enthusiasm to non-human sports like horse and dog racing. The financial stakes in horse racing, thanks to legalized betting, dwarf those in human endurance racing. And sure enough, for the first half of the 20th century, thoroughbreds and humans got faster at roughly similar rates. But according to a 2006 analysis by University of Nottingham researcher David Gardner, winning times at major races like the Kentucky Derby and the Epsom Derby have remained stagnant since about 1950. Over the same period, winning times at major marathons, such as the Olympics, continued to drop by more than 15%. A champion marathoner and a champion horse are both physiological marvels. The difference is that the marathoner can look beyond the present moment. Secretariat's Kentucky Derby record of 159.4 has stood since 1973. Nearly 30 years later, in 2001, Monarcos became only the second horse to dip under 2 minutes at the Derby, winning by 5 lengths. Could he have challenged Secretariat's record? Perhaps, if Secretariat had been there in front of him. But only humans can make the abstract leap to virtual competition. If you know that someone, somewhere, has covered a given distance in 159.4, you know that it's possible to cover that distance in 159.3, and you can guide your training and execute your race plan accordingly. Of course, believing you can run a 2-hour, 5-minute marathon isn't the same as running it. Philosophers make a distinction between justified beliefs and true beliefs. You can have a good reason for believing something, that your car is in the garage, for example, even if it turns out not to be true because someone's stolen it. Conversely, you can believe something that turns out to be true, that you will draw an ace, for no good reason. Knowledge, according to some philosophical accounts, requires justified true belief. For athletes, the simplest way of acquiring justified true belief about your capabilities is to test them. Whatever you've done before, you can do again, plus a little more. But the question raised by Noakes and Marcora and others is whether, for most of us, such incrementally justified beliefs understate our true capacities. To advance into uncharted territory, to, say, improve the marathon record by 3 minutes rather than 3 seconds, as Eliud Kipchoge hopes to do, requires an imaginative leap. Just before the 35-kilometer mark, as the runners head up a short hill, Kulseit surges into the lead. There are just 4 runners left in contention at this point. As Kulseit presses ahead, 2-hour, 8-minute marathoner Nixon Machichim begins to drift back, losing contact with the group. Later, he drops out. For the remainder of the race, the runners have to push through a gusting headwind. Kulseit's quads are burning, and his stride starts to look slow and jerky. Finally, with just over 2 miles left to finish, his 2 remaining rivals, a 2-hour, 7-minute runner and a 2-hour, 5-minute runner, begin to pull away. As he falters in the wind, it becomes clear that he will miss the national record. But the journalists aboard the press truck are buzzing nonetheless. Despite the terrible conditions, he ends up running 2 hours, 10 minutes, 55 seconds for third place, to become the second fastest Canadian in history and lock up a spot on the Olympic team. But it's how he did it, rather than the time itself, that sticks in my mind. This book isn't a training manual. Still, it's impossible to explore the nature of human limits without wondering about the best ways to transcend them. In the end, the most effective limit changers are still the simplest, so simple that we've barely mentioned them. If you want to run faster, it's hard to improve on the training haiku penned by Mayo Clinic physiologist Michael Joyner, the man whose 1991 journal paper foretold the 2-hour marathon chase. Run a lot of miles, some faster than your race pace. Rest once in a while. Joyner is one of the world's leading experts in the physiology of human endurance, but he gleefully describes himself as a tech nudie. At one conference on the future of sports technology and performance enhancement, Joyner brought, as a prop, his vintage 1972 boxer's jump rope. All the blandishments of modern sports science, altitude tents and heart rate variability tracking and bioengineered sports drinks and so on, amount to minor tinkering compared to the more elemental task of pushing your mind and body in training day after day for years. In fact, the very objectivity promised by sports technology turns out to be self-limiting in some contexts. Aiming to ride your bike at a specific target heart rate or power output is like even pacing on steroids. It reduces the risk of a blow-up, but takes away the possibility of a breakthrough. As elite track coach Steve Magnus has written, technological enhancements like running with a GPS watch slacken the bond between perception and action. Ecological psychologists often use motorcycle riding as an illustration. You can monitor your speed by feeling the sensation of the bike and the rhythm of the road as the world flows past. Or you can look at the speedometer. The latter is more precise, but for experts, at least, it's not a better way of assessing whether you're moving safely. Similarly, by checking your power meter before deciding whether to speed up or slow down when cycling, you're inserting an extra cognitive step that relies on an imperfect external estimate of how you should be feeling rather than on the feeling itself. So, if the basics of training are simple and widely understood, does all this research about the brain's hidden reserves teach us anything new? I think all the great coaches always work on the brain anyway, Tim Noakes told me. But not everyone has a great coach, or any coach at all, for that matter. I really do think most of us can do a better job of accessing those hidden reserves. In particular, this is a relatively untapped area of improvement for those who are already training at a high level and possibly maxing out their potential for physical gains. Maybe approaches like brain training and brain stimulation will pan out and deliver predictable and repeatable performance improvements. Or perhaps we'll have to rely on lower-tech ways of directly wrestling with our beliefs, like self-talk. Of course, the power of belief has often been oversold, like the self-help books that claim sub-4-minute miles became easy as soon as Roger Bannister showed it was possible. In any honest accounting, training is the cake and belief is the icing. But sometimes that thin smear of frosting makes all the difference. Since Samuel Marcora's 2014 study showing that simple training in motivational self-talk could extend time to exhaustion in a cycling test, several other studies have confirmed that the technique can alter the relationship between pace and effort. A British field experiment found that self-talk training boosted performance in a grueling 60-mile overnight ultramarathon. Stephen Chung's research, described in Chapter 8, found that cyclists performed better in 95-degree heat after self-talk training that focused specifically on handling hot weather. If I could go back in time to alter the course of my own running career after a decade of writing about the latest research in endurance training, the single biggest piece of advice I would give to my doubt-filled younger self would be to pursue motivational self-talk training with diligence and no snickering. In the end, though, what has captivated me about the new wave of brain-centered endurance research isn't really its performance-boosting potential. For millions of people around the world, endurance challenges are somewhere between a hobby and an addiction, a form of grueling self-test that has no particular health justification. Why? If races were really just plumbing contests, tests of whose pipes could deliver the most oxygen and pump the most blood, they would be boringly deterministic. You race once, and you know your limits. But that's not how it works. As a college freshman on the track team, I once had a disheartening conversation with a girl on the basketball team whom I hoped to impress. She had an upcoming game, I had an upcoming meet, and we were discussing how nervous we were. "Why are you nervous?" she asked. "It's not like trying to hit a free throw in front of a screaming crowd. Isn't it just the gun goes, everybody runs, and whoever's fastest wins?" I tried to explain to her that every good race involved exceeding what felt like my physical limits. If I ran 800 meters as hard as I could in practice, I might run 210. In a race, I might run 155. Accessing that hidden reserve was anything but a foregone conclusion, and waiting to see how deep I would manage to dig was what made racing both exhilarating and terrifying. I never did get a date with her. These days, the terror has mostly, though not entirely, faded. When I line up for a race, I remind myself that my fiercest opponent will be my own brain's well-meaning protective circuitry. It's a lesson I first learned in my breakthrough 1500-meter race in Sherbrooke more than two decades ago, but its implications continue to surprise me. I'm eager to learn more in the coming years about which signals the brain responds to, how those signals are processed, and, yes, whether they can be altered. But it's enough for now to know that when the moment of truth comes, science has confirmed what athletes have always believed, that there's more in there, if you're willing to believe it. 2 hours, May 6th, 2017. The thing about a 2-hour marathon under the heavily scripted conditions that Nike has orchestrated is that it should be almost comically boring. If all goes well, there will be no surges, no breaks, no comebacks, and not even the slightest variation in pace. Just three men, an arrowhead, and a clock. Despite these facts, the Breaking 2 race appears to be the hottest unofficial ticket in Italy, even though it's not open to the public. Samuel Marcora, who grew up in the town of Busto Arsizio, 25 miles from Monza, is home looking after his mother while on sabbatical from the University of Kent. I pull every string at my disposal to get him accredited as a media commentator, since I'm eager to hear his take in real time on this ultimate test of endurance. It's not until 4 a.m. on the day of the race, which is slated to start at 5:45 a.m., that I'm finally able to send him a message confirming that he's in. He replies immediately, "I was awake waiting for your message. Couldn't sleep." In the pre-dawn gloom, the bustle of final preparations at the Formula One track feels hushed and surreal. After a lengthy and sleepless red-eye flight, a full day of deadline reporting, and a scant few hours of rest, I've passed through the stage of feeling tired and instead am pleasantly buzzed on adrenaline and Nutella-smeared croissants. I've been telling people on Twitter who ask for predictions that I give Kipchoge and company a 1-10% chance of success. Either that, or I reply with a gif of Clubber Lang from Rocky III saying, "Prediction? Pain." I have an all-too-familiar feeling in the pit of my stomach, along with a leaden heaviness in my legs that I know from long experience is not physical but mental. I'm having sympathy pains for Kipchoge, who is about to leap voluntarily into a chasm of unknown depths. Once the race starts, it very quickly settles into a measured, seemingly effortless rhythm. After the half-marathon debacle, the Tesla has been equipped with lasers that shine green lines onto the track, delineating an arrow-shaped wedge that follows 6 meters behind the car to show the pacers exactly where to run. There are 30 pacers here, all among the best runners in the world, and they've been rehearsing their formation and transitions all week. At the conclusion of each 1.5-mile lap, three of the six pacers drift wide and three fresh pacers merge in from either side of the arrowhead. With Kipchuj, Tadise, and Desisa tucked impassively and unchangingly behind, the pacers and their changeovers, undertaken at high speed and with the very real risk,